morning, buddy. Please be seated. Let's go ahead and call our first case, which is case number 56527, McKnight Family LLP versus the Debt Management Services et al. Mr. Kent representing the appellant, Mr. Haskin, the response. Mr. Kent, you may proceed.
Thank you, John. As noted, my name is James Kent. I represent the appellant, McKnight Family. May it please the court, opposing counsel. Before I start, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Okay.
We believe that the first error by the lower court was with regard to the extension of the original stipulation.
Excuse me, Mr. Kent, for 1 second. I apologize for that. Chief Justice Pickering and Justice Hardesty are testifying for the legislature at this moment in Carson City. They are going to participate in the case, and they will listen to the podcast at the conclusion before we vote on it and make a decision.
Okay.
Sorry to interrupt you.
No problem at all. We believe that there was the first error was in the lower court not agreeing or finding that, in fact, the original stipulation did, in fact, have a deadline removed by the emails of the two parties. I think it is clear in the law that, in fact, the emails, electronic emails, are, in fact, writings with signatures, and therefore they constitute a valid writing for a stipulation as required within the statutes. The only question was whether there was any deadline put on it. I believe that the emails of July 17th, that in fact Mr. Grody, counsel for the respondents, was in fact looking for dates in which his clients could meet. And my emails and Mr. Kent's emails prior to that indicated clearly that if we can't meet in the next few weeks, then in fact we're going to be pushing the deadline. We need to get an extension. Mr. Grody said his responsive email indicated, I don't have dates yet when my clients can meet. I agree to the extension. And basically what that did is it removed the 30-day deadline. Mm-hmm. There was then subsequent presentation of a stipulation that would have imposed a 30-day deadline, but as the court found, that was never executed by the respondents, and it was never filed, never signed, and therefore was no force or effect. The actions of the parties also justify that, in fact, the deadline had been removed. By the first stipulation, it was effective upon execution. The only date on that document was July 9th of 2009. Therefore, 30 days from that deadline would have been August 9th. In fact, the parties weren't able to meet until August 20th. And therefore, at that point, they would have been in reliance that the stipulation to stop all proceedings was still in force and effect.
As to that original stipulation, my understanding it was never presented to the court, is that not right?
It was never presented to the court for signature. It was filed with the courts, though.
At what time, though?
It was filed, the file stamp was July 21st.
But that was after the original proceedings, correct? Because my understanding was it was not initially filed with the court. No bond was posted or anything like that that vacated the original TPO request in order.
Upon getting the TRO from the court on the ex parte basis, we then contacted Mr. Grody, who we have been in communications with, said we can post the bond, we've got a hearing date set.
But no bond was posted, correct?
No bond was posted pursuant to the stipulation that said we were going to forego all litigation as well as all foreclosure.
And when was that stipulation filed with the court?
That was filed July
21st. Is there a reason, going back just procedurally trying to understand this case, why arbitration or mediation wasn't requested with the real estate folks?
In 2000,
going to the court and asking for this?
In 2008, the McKnight family, the respondents in this matter, did in fact file a complaint with the real estate division. And that was under investigation. In fact, there was correspondence within the record indicating to the HOA that, in fact, the complaint had been filed. But it was taking a year in order, or ultimately we discovered by response that it was almost a year before a decision came back. Prior to that decision being rendered by the real estate division, the foreclosure sale was proceeding, which necessitated by the urgency that we had to go in and do something to stop the sale. And so therefore that's where the litigation was in fact started, but then stipulated and agreed to be put on hold as well as the sale until we could try and meet and settle matters. And then even at the meeting back on August 20th, in fact, there was no mention that a sale had been put back on calendar, that in fact, that there was any discussion of a stipulation ending at any time and proceeding again on the merits of the case. In fact, when the parties left the August 20th meeting, there was an indication that we need to meet again, but there was no deadline put on it. There was no meeting time. Both parties had to get documents, gather documents, present documents to each other to try and resolve it. Even then, as late as September 23rd, Mr. Grody's email indicates that when the stipulation expires, his clients plan to move forward. So the reliance by McKnight family was that, in fact, the stipulation had been in place, the deadline had been removed, and they relied upon that.
There were a couple of stipulations, and finally, we had September 4th action, the postponed trustee sale until October 23rd. During that period, additional emails were sent by the McKnight family, and nothing was received back. What obligation were they under to continue to keep this open and stay proceedings?
The respondents, the HOA?
Yes.
They were under the obligation because the September, or the July 16th or 17th email from Mr. Grody indicating, I agree, we need the extension. And at that point, there was no deadline. The deadline, in fact, was removed from the original stipulation. That was the agreement. An extension was put into place. So at that point, either party could have rescinded the stipulation upon no reasonable notice to the other. But at that point, it really became an open-ended extension because he didn't have dates when his clients could meet. When we did meet, there was no deadline put on when can we meet again, because we didn't know when we were going to get the documents. It was dependent upon some third parties to get documents from. So at that point, there was no deadline. There was no ending time as to when things had to go. It could have been revoked probably by either side at any point upon notice to the other side, similar to the filing of a three-day notice of intent to default.
Mr. King, can I ask you about the quiet title action and whether or not how it interplays with NRS 38.310?
Yes. 38.310 allows for the interpretation and enforcement of the bylaws. The quiet title action really goes to the effect that by filing the notice of default, the liens against the property improperly, were in fact then clouding the title. And it wasn't necessarily whether there was a lien, whether there was money owed, but that actually went to the effect of the collection practices, the unlawful, as our position was, the unlawful failure to apply when monies were paid. The practice was that the HOA would forward the money to the collection agency, and the collection agency would or would not apply, and they might send money back. And that was an illegal activity under the statutes. And therefore, what the actions were was not necessarily an interpretation of the bylaws or an enforcement of the bylaws, but actually a violation of statute. And therefore, that's where the quiet title action was predominantly based upon.
Okay. Thank you.
I would like to, it was included in, but I think it's very important to provide this quote from the California case of General Insurance versus Superior Court. It indicates other cases have noted the patent unfairness of allowing a party to enter into an open-ended stipulation from which they derive a benefit and then trying to penalize the plaintiff for granting them the stipulation in the first place. The stipulation allowed the respondents to not have to go through the expense of litigation. It allowed both parties to move forward in settlement, which was a benefit to both parties. And for the respondents to just place the property on sale without notice to the appellants was an unfair practice by them, and it was severely, obviously, prejudicial. We believe that, in fact, as the stipulation took the sales off, postponed the sales by a writing, it was not an oral proclamation that, in fact, postponed the sales. It was, in fact, the stipulation, the writing, that postponed the sales. and therefore an oral proclamation wasn't sufficient. The notice has to be reasonable. And if there is a writing to effectuate the removal of the sale date, it would make sense that the same medium, a writing, be used to put the sale back on. Again, at no point did respondents provide notice, written, oral, or any other means, to us that a sale was, in fact, taking place. With regard to the dismissal of the case, we believe that the allowance for removal to mediation or arbitration is upon the commencement of the action. The statute's very clear. And when a statute is clear on its plain meaning, it has to be given that by the courts. At the time this action commenced, there was injunctive relief that was being requested, that was being asked for, and in fact, that was being applied for by virtue of the TRO. When that was, in fact, obtained, and the litigation then proceeded, at that point thereafter, there was no basis whatsoever in terms of having it go back to mediation or arbitration. That would have only invited piecemeal litigation, and in fact, by having the merits heard before the court, it was better just one court, one decision.
Thank you. And you have about four minutes, 41 seconds.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Askin.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Your Honor, before I begin, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, if I could.
Do you have a cross appeal?
We do have an appeal ourselves, Your Honor, related to it.
Okay, you may do so then. Okay.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, may it please opposing counsel. This action really relates to interpretation of facts, and I'd like to set that matter clear from the beginning because I think that gives us good context. The appellant has requested that this court review the district court's determinations regarding the supposed stipulation on a de novo basis. We contend that it's a clearly erroneous basis because really what the appellants are asking this court to do is interpret the factual understandings and factual findings of the court with respect to what's transpired related to certain emails and stipulations and writings rather than an interpretation of the local rule 7.50, which of course requires that any stipulation be placed in writing. Having that said as the backdrop, I'd like to kind of quickly review the court's findings at the district court level. The district court found that the parties did, in fact, enter into a stipulation on July 9th, 2009 that was filed with the court on July 21st, 2009. The court then further found that that stipulation vacated the injunction hearing and continued everything for a period of 30 days through August 21st, 2009, the date of the filing. The court further found that while the parties discussed a second stipulation, the second stipulation was never reduced to writing, signed by the parties, and filed with the court. The court further found that the first stipulation expired on August 21st, 2009, and that there was no valid second stipulation ever entered into because it's admitted by the parties it was never signed. However, what we're really talking about here today, and as briefed by the appellants...
Counsel, also the signing, we're talking about electronic transmission. Wasn't there some type of response, at least indicating counsel's name or something to one of the emails?
Your Honor, no, there wasn't. There was an email exchange in mid-July, I believe July 17th, and the email exchange is an email from Mr. Kent to Mr. Grody that does say, pursuant to our prior communications, he's attaching a second stipulation. And here's what's important. I'm attaching here to a second moratorium stipulation for 30 days from the date of our settlement meeting, August 20th. And then he sends it and he requires a signature back. He says, sign it and send it back to me, either facsimile or email. But here's the important distinction, Your Honors. What the appellant is really contending is that this second stipulation that's before this court is frankly irrelevant. What the appellant wants to say is that there's a third stipulation, an open-ended extension, if you will. Now, granted, you'll never see the words open extension used in any communication, email, or otherwise. It's frankly not included in the second stipulation. The second stipulation that's sent to opposing counsel that's drafted by the appellant and sent to opposing counsel, my client states that the parties are going to enter into a 30-day extension, but it also says, and this is very important, that any additional time may be granted by further agreement in writing. The parties contemplate, one, that there's going to be a 30-day stipulation, and two, if there's going to be another one and any additional time granted, that additional time has to be in writing. Now, what appellant's referring to is some third stipulation that's frankly concocted. It doesn't exist. It's this agreement that somehow there's an open extension. And again, revisiting what I just stated earlier, the belief is that somehow that there's a communication regarding open extension, but there's not. There's no email, there's no writing, there's no stipulation. And in fact, Mr. Kent testified during the evidentiary hearing that there's no writing and there were no words of open extension ever used. His testimony at the evidentiary hearing was, when I sent the stipulation and never got it back, I believe that the term was then changed, that it was an open extension. That's at page 137, lines 19 through 22 on the transcript. So his belief that was never expressed to anybody, in writing or otherwise, was once I sent the second stipulation and I never got it back, I believe that somehow there now had to be an open extension in time. Despite the fact that there is this email from Mr. Kent sending the second stipulation saying, sign it, send it back to me, and any additional extensions have to be in writing. I'd like to also add that with respect to Torrey Pines and my clients, they did conduct themselves in a manner believing that there was indeed a second stipulation. Mr. Grady testified at the evidentiary hearing that that's how he conducted himself, saying that he believed that he did enter into the second stipulation that would continue the foreclosure action for another 30 days. And in fact, that's exactly how he conducted himself. The parties had an August 20, 2009 settlement conference that did not result in settlement. There were communications after that by Mr. Grady to Mr. Kent stating, where are we? How are we going to conclude this? Then there's another email that appellant acknowledged during their argument on September 23 saying, look, if we're not going to get anywhere, we're moving forward with foreclosure. And that warning was issued 1 month prior to the actual foreclosure sale on October 23rd.
Now, I asked that issue. Was that a warning or was that notice of sale? Counsel said his client was not notified of the sale.
Your Honor, that was a warning from Mr. Grody to the appellant in this case. In terms of notices of sale, there were certificates of postponement, three of them issued by the trustee in this case. Each of them issued pursuant to law and pursuant to NRS 116.3.1164 that allows for the trustee to, from time to time, postpone the sale by such advertisement or notice as it considers reasonable. By proclamation made to the persons assembled at the time and place previously set and advertised for the sale. That's exactly what the trustee did in this case on three separate occasions. I believe the last time they did that was on September 4th, 2009, for the August 23rd, 2009 sale. Your Honor, then moving on to the second issue, which related to the dismissal of the claims. The law on NRS 38.310 is fairly clear that the court shall dismiss any civil action which is commenced in violation of the provision of subsection 1, which of course relates to actions that involve the interpretation, application, or enforcement of CC&Rs. Exempt from that are any claims related to injunctive relief for irreparable harm or claims for regarding title of property. The appellant in this case filed a 7-count complaint, then filed a First Amendment complaint that had the exact 7 counts afterwards. Two of those causes of action are inarguably exempt, and those actions were decided at the evidentiary hearing. Those are the ones that relate to the injunctive relief and the slander of title causes of action. And again, those were determined at the evidentiary hearing. What appellant contends is that, and they say, you know, we had one year of actions going on. But that's kind of looking at this case in a vacuum. Okay, what we really need to do is step outside of it and look at this case, how it really transpired. You had a complaint in a TRO in early July 2009. You then have this stipulation, and the sale occurs in late October 2009. There's nothing going on. No answers, nothing going on. The sale occurs in October 2009, and after the sale takes place, now you have a motion brought by the appellant to overturn the sale. You also have a motion to dismiss brought by my clients against the first complaint. The motion to dismiss is heard first by the court. The court determines, we don't want to hear this yet. We want to get the injunctive relief out of the way. So the court denies the motion. The court at the end, and we also realize, by the way, at that hearing, that a first amended complaint has been filed but never served on the parties.
Did the court treat the injunctive relief request as a consolidated preliminary injunction and permanent injunction hearing?
Correct, Your Honor. That's how the court
treated it. So it's a full disposition of the injunction issue.
Yeah, absolutely, Your Honor. And the court, in its order denying the motion to dismiss, says we want to hear this injunction hearing before we rule on any dismissal. That's why it was denied. The injunction hearing is then heard. We have the disposition. There's a second motion to dismiss filed by my clients against the First Amendment complaint. That is then heard. And the non-exempt claims, which are the only claims before the court at that time, because the exempt claims have now been decided, the court decides we're going to dismiss those based on 38.310, which was the proper decision. Appellant contends that this was piecemealing, but I'd like to, this Supreme Court and the courts of Nevada has stated in the Hand case, concludes that Nevada's public policy favoring arbitration of disputes involving the interpretation of enforcement and CC&Rs is paramount. And that's what they got the injunctive relief causes of action out of the way, and they then dismissed the rest of those claims. Finally, Your Honor, turning to our subject of appeal, which is the denial of attorney's fees, I think this matter is quite clear in that we have a CC&R provision and we have a statute 116.3116, subsection 7, that are virtually identical. That state a judgment or decree in any action brought under this section must include costs and reasonable attorney's fees for the prevailing party. The court in this action denied a request for attorney's fees and costs without really any explanation at all. The statute is quite clear, and when the statute is clear on its face, it has to be construed, same with the contractual language, and the court is not at privy to offer any of its own interpretations. In this action, there's no question that the McKnight family brought an action related to the foreclosure actions under 116 and the lien actions under 116 that were used as the basis for Torrey Pines, my client, to place a lien on the property and eventually foreclose. We would ask that this court overturn the court's ruling with respect to the denial of attorney's fees and remand that for an amount to be determined. Based on that, I reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Kent.
Thank you. First, I would like to go back. The point is that the court made a finding that there was an oral agreement. The point is there never was an oral agreement. There was the second stipulation, which the court noted was never a force in effect because it wasn't effectuated by either party. That leaves us with the emails. And throughout the proceedings, the court noted there is an extension. It's just a matter of whether it's 30 days or whether it's open-ended. So there was no oral agreement. And therefore, there's an interpretation as to whether those emails the court believed were an oral agreement, whether those emails actually fell within the statute as an electronic record. I think, to Justice, your question with regard, was the email signed? Mr. Brody did, in fact, sign it by leaving his mark of his name, Matt. And there is case law in our brief that supports the fact that an electronic mark or signature such as that versus just a blanket stamp of your firm's name justifies that it is a mark just as if you signed a regular letter or mailing. The email did in fact state by Mr. Brody, I will stipulate to another extension of time. I will let you know what dates work as soon as I am advised by my client. At that point, there's no indication whatsoever that this is going to be a 30-day extension because he doesn't even know what dates his clients have available. And even as we met on August 20th, there was still no discussion of dates because, in fact, it was impossible due to the need of third parties to provide documents for us to be able to schedule a date or a deadline in the matter. With regard to what actually occurred or what was this hearing for, the court was clear several times throughout the hearing what the hearing was for, and it can be no more clear than in the court's order itself. The court orders plaintiff's motion to set aside the sale of real property denied. That's all it was. It was whether or not the sale of property should have taken place. It wasn't on the merits of any of the causes of action. It wasn't on the injunctive relief. It wasn't on the TRO. It was simply, should the sale be set aside or not? The court made no other findings, no other conclusions of law, and no other decision other than that.
So is there a hearing set specifically under Rule 65 on your request for a preliminary injunction and permanent injunction? Or how did that procedurally take place?
When the TRO was originally granted, there was a hearing set for, I believe it was July 21st. But by virtue of the stipulation of July 9th, that hearing was taken off calendar.
Okay.
During the proceedings at the evidentiary hearing, because some of the questioning did start getting into the subject matters and the court brought us back, and we defined, no, we're only here for this. Let's take care of this. And then we'll proceed and move on to the other matters if, in fact, it necessitates at that point. But let's stay focused. This is the only thing I want to know right now.
So you're saying the court never ruled on the request for a preliminary injunction and permanent injunction?
Correct.
Feeling that the other rulings mooted the necessity to do that?
I believe so. Correct, John.
Okay.
With regard to respondents' request for attorney's fees, I think it's very clear that stated in the case that we cited, generally, however, the prevailing party is the party who prevails on significant issues in the litigation. Naturally, in order to decide which party has prevailed on the significant issues, in most cases, the litigation must have come to an end because at the conclusion of a case, the trial court is in the best position to decide who has prevailed. In this instance, there was no conclusion. The court simply said this one particular motion is, in fact, denied. And now the question is whether the case should continue to commence, whether it be it in, or by the court's subsequent dismissal of the case, the court said, take your case now to mediation or arbitration. So there was no final decision upon the merits, and thus the court erred, or I believe the court was correct, when it did not grant attorney's fees. The last point I'd like to make, and I think this is very important also, is with regard to the reasonableness of the notice. Again, even though they had set a new sale date, when we met face-to-face, there was no mention of the new sale date by Mr. Grody nor any of his parties, including those that were, in fact, the ones executing the sale. Nothing was ever provided, notice, written, which it should have been, or orally. So, in conclusion, we believe that there was a stipulation by virtue of the emails, which are writings, that, in fact, removed the deadline. No subsequent deadline was ever imposed. And even if one had been imposed, there was no notice that the sales were being put back on. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Askin.
Thank you, Your Honors. Addressing the very first issue, what did, and to ask a rhetorical of this court, what exactly did Mr. Grody sign in that email? And we should just look at the email. It's before this court. Pursuant to our communications, I am attaching here to a second moratorium stipulation for 30 days from the date of our settlement meeting, August 20th. There is a time beginning and there is a time ending included in that email. So even if you believe that this email in and of itself constitutes the second stipulation, there's a date beginning, there's a date ending. And then when he sends along the second stipulation, there's
if I can stop you at this point. You requested additional 3 minutes as to your counterclaim. That counterclaim's asked to attorney's fees, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct, Your Honor.
If you wish to respond to that, please.
I will address that earlier. Appellants contend that this case was not concluded, and that's the basis why the court did not award attorney's fees. However, this case was concluded. The association is the prevailing party. The claims, the non-exempt claims, were decided by that point. You had exempt claims decided by that point. You had non-exempt claims left. The district court dismissed that based on 38.310,
and appellants contend, well, we were remanded to now go to arbitration or mediation. But the question really is, what if the appellants decided never to arbitrate or never to mediate the claim? That is in their hands. They are not forced to arbitrate. They are not forced to mediate. And indeed, they haven't. The case is concluded at that point because the issue has been decided. The association prevailed with respect to its foreclosure action. And again, unless the appellants go back to arbitration or mediation or non-binding, however they want to proceed, then the action recommences. But the action, for all intents and purposes, has concluded at that point. I have nothing further.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for your excellent arguments and briefs. We'll take this matter in submission. As I said earlier, give our colleagues a chance to listen to the oral arguments before we deliberate and make our decision. And the court will now be in recess until 11:30 this morning.